Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me today is my mother and co-host, Caroline Kilborn.
And hello, everyone. Pardon me for my funny voice, but that's what happens when you have a lot of something in the air.
Ah, yes.
Pollen.
It is allergy season here in Iowa. No doubt about that.
Is it ever.
But aren't the flowering trees just so beautiful?
Oh, the red buds are unbelievable.
The red buds, the flowering pears, the ornamental pears, the magnolias.
Everything.
The crab apples are coming on. The actual apple trees are in bloom.
Yeah.
Spring has finally arrived.
Spring has sprung, yes.
As they say. So, what are we going to spring on our listeners today, Mom?
Well, today we're going to spring on something that's going to be very interesting. And the name of it is Grievous. It's by H.S. Cross, and she is the author of Wilberforce, if our listeners are familiar with that. She was born in Grosse Pointe, Michigan, and educated at Harvard, and has taught at Friends Seminary in New York City, among other schools. Her debut novel, Wilberforce, was published in 2015, and this one is connected with that, and we'll find out how that goes. This is an interesting book, very interesting book.
Welcome to Writer's Voices, and may I call you Heather?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Hi.
So Heather, let's start with a little bit more about your background and how you became a novelist.
Well, I grew up actually as a child actor. So I from the age of five, there was a children's theater in my town. So I just did a ton of theater and loved it and always was going to go into the theater. And in college, I started directing and then writing also for the theater and kind of gradually drifted away from that and began doing more fiction writing and drifted into novel writing from there. And I also was a full-time classroom teacher for quite a while. So it's sort of a slow road to novel writing.
But a successful one.
Well, we'll see, right?
Well, your debut novel, Wilberforce, was published, like Mom said, in 2015. Was this the first completed novel that you wrote or just the first to be published?
The first to be published. It was maybe the, third completed novel that I'd written. And, you know, the first two just didn't quite make it. And then this was the one to finally break through.
You know, we've talked to a number of authors who have had similar experiences where it took 2, 3, 4, 5 novels under their belt before they found a publisher. And of course, you've been published by one of the largest publishers in the business. So, which is Farrar Straus Giroux. Is that how it's pronounced?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or everyone calls it FSG.
FSG. And
What
kept you going through number one not working, number two not working? What kept you going?
Well, it was just sort of the inability to stop writing the stories, really, and to leave the imaginary worlds alone. I just couldn't really do it. Certainly wasn't the hope of stardom or getting published. You know, that was just sort of a fantasy. So it was that I couldn't give up the people that I was writing about and the stories and stop playing around with them, really.
Well, Wilberforce and Grievous are both set at St. Stephen's, which is a public school in the UK, and I'll let you describe that a little bit more. And in the early 1900s, late 1920s, 1930s, something like that. And were your earlier books set in the same place?
No, the first book that I finished was actually one of those thinly veiled autobiographical novels, you know, that was set in Grosse Pointe in the 1980s. It wasn't true, but it was about, you know, an eighth grader who was into children's theater. And it was really much more commercial in a way, and sort of conventional than Wilberforce and Grievous are style-wise. You know, it came close, it just didn't quite sell. And, you know, so it, part of of probably writing Grievous and Wilberforce with the experimental, I mean, to the degree that they're experimental style-wise, I mean, they're not crazy, but was I'd tried all the conventional stuff and it hadn't worked, you know, hadn't sold. And so at a certain point I was like, well, forget it. I'm just going to write what I want to write. And I did.
Right.
But no, so I've written things set in the present day or the near present day, first person narrators, female narrators, you know, different, you know, quite different things. So, but this St. Stephen's material is probably the material that really, stuck with me and, you know, infected me and that it was hardest for me to give up. And why I kept going with it.
You know, when you say public school, I immediately thought, oh, public school. Well, this is not a public school. It's a private school.
Right. Exactly right. So in England, the, quote, public schools are private, boarding schools primarily or certainly originally. They were called public schools because the early ones were founded, you know, kind of Henry VIII time or a little bit after as you know, institutions for poor scholars, so that originally they were, you know, charity schools because there weren't any such thing as state education then. But, of course, over time they became very elite private schools, although all of them do still have scholarship classes and so on, you know, like any private school here. So, yeah, so they are private boarding schools, and St. Stephen's is a boys' boarding school that I made up. That it's modeled after the famous ones, say Eton or Harrow, Winchester, but it's more third rate than they are. And, you know, the kind of kids that go to St. Stephen's are not as aristocratic as that you would see in the student body of those famous schools. It's more clergymen's kids, sons, or the sort of rising professional class, or the colonial service class. So it's that sort of upper middle professional class of people, more than the, you know, lord's sons type of thing.
What was interesting to me as a former school teacher was that the parents were not, they just weren't connected with the students. I mean, and
right.
The teachers, you know, there was just kind of a vacuum there somehow.
And do you think
right.
That's common in kids that go to public school, to boarding school in England, at least during that time, where the parents were sort of absentee?
I think at the time, yes. Certainly not today. I mean, there's nowhere in the privileged world where the parents aren't quite involved. But, yeah, it definitely would have been common in anybody's memoirs that were written at the time. You see that. I mean, part of it is just communication. You know, you would have had the letters from your kid. Your son would be writing you maybe a letter a week. It would have been kind of an assigned thing to write. So maybe depending on your relationship, you might have a correspondence with him. And you would get the term report from the school, the equivalent of the report card. But that was about it. You know, there wasn't all this telephoning back and forth constantly. So how a parent would become highly involved is a question. Especially, I mean, some schools were maybe in the home counties. I purposely set this one in a very remote area where there isn't a half-term break. Parents are not, like, going up there to visit. It's just too far away. And I did that on purpose just to sort of keep the parents out of the picture. But if you went to a school that was nearer where your parents lived, they might come take you out on the weekend or occasionally, or you might go home at the half-term break or something. But also a lot of these parents were, some of these parents, and the same with the kids at St. Stephen's, they are in the colonies somewhere. They're in the colonial service. They're abroad. Some of these kids might not see their parents for years. They would be going home to some relative or friends or something like that, because people are just, they're just far flung. And to send your son to boarding school, even into, you know, the 70s or 80s when you were abroad, was just how you got him a decent education, you know. My late husband was British, and he was born in Kenya because his parents were working in hotels in Kenya. And he went back to England to boarding school at 13. And it's just, it was the only way to get your son, you know, a decent education that could lead to, you know, Oxford or some kind of university or some serious career. So it's what you had to do, whether you really wanted to be away from him or not.
today Chinese businessmen do that, send their kids to yes. British boarding schools.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Now, I assume there were boarding schools for girls, too.
Yes, there were. Not as many as for boys, but there certainly were. Now some of these famous schools are either co-ed entirely or co-ed in the senior classes, like the sixth form, that the last year or two might be co-ed, or there might be girls in the daytime but not boarding, or, you know, a mixture. It depends on the school.
Oh, uh-huh.
But there also are girls' schools, too, like Cheltenham Ladies College is a famous girls' public school, or St. Paul's Girls' School. There are a few, but many more for boys, because historically, the boys, you know, there was a reason to educate the boys more than the girls.
Do you have any plans to write a book about the girls' boarding school? Or?
No, I don't. It's funny. They somehow really don't interest me. There are, in the canon of the school story, like Angela Brazel famously wrote a whole bunch of, you know, a whole series of very popular novels for kids. At girls' boarding schools, you know, the jolly hockey sticks kind of story. That's where that phrase came from. There's just something about the male world that intrigues me in a way that the all-female world doesn't. And that's just the way my brain works. It's nothing intrinsically more or less interesting.
What actually drew you to this setting, to a boys' public school in the United Kingdom in the 1930s? Was there something that you read, something that you heard that just attracted your attention to that?
Yeah, you get struck by things, right? I was a teenager. I guess I was in 11th grade. I was 16, and I happened upon a BBC dramatization of Rudyard Kipling's Stocky and Company, which is a collection of short stories that he wrote that are sort of loosely based on his school days, although it's fiction. And in the 80s, the BBC dramatized this, and it was on cable when I was a teenager, and I happened upon it. And I was just absolutely attracted to it in every way, and I didn't even really understand it. And I found the book in the library and read it, and even as school literature, it's quite obscure. I mean, Kipling is an amazing writer. It's very underwritten. I hardly understood it. You know, I didn't know what was prep, what are houses, and there wasn't any, you know, Harry Potter or those novels to give me any perspective, and you couldn't look things up on the internet. There was no internet. So it took me a very long time to even start to understand it, but for some reason, it was, the atmosphere of it was completely intoxicating to me. And so, through that, or, you know, gradually after that, I read other school stories because the characters in that are mocking certain school stories, and I looked those up and read those too, and so on and so forth. And, you know, friends introduce you to other friends. So it was this sort of very irrational obsession for, you know, a very girly 16-year-old American sort of sheltered Midwestern girl to have. And I it was peculiar. And I knew it was peculiar, but I just couldn't really... You know, you can't exactly argue with what grips you.
And, of course, the characters in Grievous are familiar with Stocky and Company as well.
They sure are. They're very obsessed with it.
So I'm guessing that you have read that book multiple times.
Yes. less so recently, but back in the day, yeah. Interestingly, I've met quite a few women, most of them are British or Australian women, who also were really into Stocky and Company when they were teenagers, even though there's no women in it, you know, it's just a completely male book. And I just find it interesting that there are other women out there that have a similar fixation to me, and none of us can understand it.
So I just looked it up on Wikipedia, and there's a quote in here. It says, Teddy Roosevelt disdained the novel, calling it a story which ought never to have been written, for there is hardly a single form of meanness which it does not seem to extol, or of school mismanagement which it does not seem to applaud.
That's a great quote. And, you know, he's not alone. All of the kind of major writers and reviewers of the time, who was it, somebody, I can't remember, who called Stocky, there are three main characters in their schoolboys, Stocky, Beetle, who's a kind of Kipling representative, and this other, their friend McTurk, they're a little threesome. Someone called them, like, you know, fiends in human likeness. I mean, these adults hated the book, but kids loved it. maybe a little bit like kids love Roald Dahl, you know, that has all this kind of horrible stuff going on it, and kids just love it. What it did was it went against this mold of the noble, you know, public school forming the character of the Christian gentleman. It was more subversive than that, and people had an issue with it.
Mm-hmm. Now, Grievous is similar in a sense. Mm-hmm. There's also a lot of bad behavior in
yes.
there, both on the adults' parts and the kids. One thing I'm wondering about is there's a lot of references in Grievous to Wilberforce.
Yes.
To what happened in Wilberforce. How important do you think it is, or how useful is it for people to read Wilberforce first?
I think it's not necessary, because, you know, any school is going to have these references to the past, and a lot of the characters in this book don't even know what happened in Wilberforce. And that's part of the fun, is that you know, they don't know. There's disagreements about what happened. It's sort of a mystery. And I mean, originally I imagined the material in Grievous first. And it just happened that the novel of Wilberforce got finished and published before Grievous did. But I had imagined these events, and then I kind of went back in my imagination to try to figure out what it was they might have been referring to, and that's how I kind of came upon the material in Wilberforce. So people that I've spoken to who've read both novels think that Grievous is a better entry novel, actually, because it's a bit broader, and it has sort of more perspectives, including female perspectives, and Wilberforce is a rougher book. Tone-wise and event-wise. So it's, you could start with it, but you could also go back to it and get the backstory, and that would be fun in a completely different way.
Mm-hmm. Are there any characters in Grievous that are based on real people, like yourself or your husband?
No. not really in either book. It's funny. I mean, I met my husband after I had begun to imagine these people. So even though he did go to these kinds of schools, it's really, I didn't get very much of it at all from him. It was something we shared. He died 11 years ago. So there's that. But not really, no. They just sort of grew up themselves in the material, and I followed them.
Do you have a favorite character and a least favorite character in these? Because there's a lot of characters in here.
There are. I love them all the same, and they would all get the same value of Christmas presents. And
same value and same quantity. You got to be careful about
that. The same value and quantity. There would be no favoritism whatsoever. You know, I go through phases. Sometimes I get tired of a person, and just really enjoy. I mean, in this book, it was really fun writing Guilford Audsley, who's a sort of minor character that comes in the second half of the book. He's an actor, and he just comes and sort of stirs everyone up. And he was really fun because he was so free and so creative, and just had a great energy to him, and woke up the creative vocations of quite a few characters in the book, and he was really fun to have around and to let loose on this more buttoned up environment. But I don't know him as well as I know the point of view characters. I mean, really, all the point of view characters, once I get inside their heads, I really just love them. Even if I'd initially thought of them as sort of the bad guy, like Pierce, who's one of the very irritating prefects in the book. He's incredibly uptight. And at first he was just the horrible guy, you know, the horrible prefect abusing his power and thinking, you know, and being narrow-minded. But once I got inside of his head, I just had to love him too in his own way. So that's what happens when you are allowed in someone's psyche that you kind of can't keep hating them.
What is a prefect?
Well, a prefect, this is a common institution in British schools, both day and boarding, but originally boarding, would be a senior boy, like in his last year or maybe 2 years, who has a kind of some responsibilities for discipline in the school. So they might be in charge of, you know, like roll call or keeping order in the dormitories or just that kind of bureaucratic keeping order. And then in many of these schools, I don't think today, but certainly then, they also had disciplinary powers, including corporal punishment. And so at St. Stephen's, you've got in each house, there are three or four boys who are the prefects of the house, and they're appointed by the housemaster in their last year or second to last year, who are, you know, doing all these chores and looking at, they really run the house. Kind of under the very general supervision of the teachers, but they're really doing it and keeping order and, you know, setting the tone and taking care of a lot of business unofficially as well, for good and for ill.
If you ask me, putting older students having disciplinary control over younger ones is a recipe for disaster. Which of course what tends to happen.
Yeah.
Well, it sometimes did, and then other times it didn't. So it depends on really the character of the institution or the house and of the people. It like anything can be certainly subject to abuse and often was, and sometimes is in grievous and sometimes isn't. So.
Right.
Well, the younger ones had to kind of be like servants to the older ones, didn't they?
Well, and that was another tradition that was not so unusual in the public schools. It, as far as I know, it doesn't really exist today. It was called the fagging system. And in that case, the word fag didn't have any sexual connotation or kind of like it wasn't a bad word, right, in the way that it is for us.
Right.
It came from the word fag, which meant to exhaust, to be exhausted, because to fag at something would be to like work really hard till you're tired. This kind of went back maybe even into the 1700s. The first year kids would be sort of servants either to an individual older boy, which is what you see going on in Grievous, or even just generally like just serve as kind of, you know, servants for the house. So just general chores that would need to be done. The first year kids might be asked to do them.
Okay.
Although asked
might not be the right word.
No, not asked, told, right. Instructed to do them. Certainly this was a system that could be abused and sometimes was. In its best light, the idea behind it was the ethos of the public school that, he who wishes to lead must first learn to serve. Because these schools, remember, they're trying to create future leaders and future colonial leaders, in particular for Britain. And so how do you form a leader? You take a boy through 6 years, through the whole cycle of being at the very bottom and being a servant. And how do you learn how to be a good leader? By being a servant first. And then you ascend to a position of leadership, either, you know, kind of like a prefect or even just as a senior boy who maybe is, you know, being a leader on a sports team or in some other way. And that's how these became the machines of creating this idea of leaders. So that was the rationale behind it.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is H.S. Cross, author of Grievous. Heather, how did you get so many details about what it would be like in a public school in that time period? Is there a lot of... a lot of material available for that?
Yes. There are quite a few novels. I mean, some of them known, some of them really obscure, that were written. It's a whole genre. But a lot of people also wrote memoirs. And so, and then there are some secondary sources that kind of collect a whole bunch of sources, people's letters and so on. And when I was, I mean, years ago when I was in college and I was still really interested in this world and I almost just wanted to go in it somehow, I just did a lot of research on it and read all these things. I would just go to the college library and find all the books that I could find and just read them, read them, read them. And since Harvard had a great library, it had, you know, really great sources. So, you know, over years of just having an interest is how I accumulated the details, and they were just in the back of my mind. And, you know, I can't even remember where I learned most of the details from and which ones I kind of made up a little bit and which ones are directly that I read somewhere that came from some exact person's memoir. I don't even know anymore. But it was the result of a many years interest that sometimes very intensely and some of it just sort of idly reading things.
Now, this was set in the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
Are there still a lot of these schools in the UK?
Yeah, I mean, pretty much all the schools that would have been around then still exist now. Not in the same form, you know, in that I think there's more day students in some of them, and like I said earlier, some of them have gone
uh-huh.
co-ed or whatever. But yeah, no, all the big great schools still exist now.
How about in the United States? Are there many boarding schools in the United States?
Well, there are, it seems to, I'm not a big expert on it. When I was growing up in the Midwest, I only knew of one. And my idea of boarding school was where you got shipped off if you were terrible. That's what I
uh-huh,
understood boarding school
uh-huh.
to be. But then when I moved to New York on the East Coast, there's a ton of boarding schools, you know, the big boarding schools like Exeter, Andover, Kent, St. Paul's, Groton, you know, all the kind of, for the United States, historical preppy boarding schools that seem to be on the East Coast.
Okay.
So people on the East Coast do go to boarding school a lot more. And I'm just not that very familiar with what goes on in, you know, the rest of the country, just because I haven't been to those schools. And I don't happen to know students who have gone to them because it tends to get kind of localized on the East Coast. But there very may well be things, and I'm just ignorant about it.
Heather, it sounds like you have worked on these books and this storyline for quite a long time. How
yes.
long exactly? When did you actually start writing this story?
Well, it depends on what one means by writing, but I began to imagine characters that became part of the book when I was 17 and tried to write things, you know, and it really wasn't any good. And, you know, between then and now, played with them and tried writing different things different ways, and stories went this way and went that way, ripped it all up, started again, took it in a different direction, ignored that or made that whole bunch of stuff a backstory, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So it's been on and off since then. Well, of course, I've been writing other things, but it's been there. Grievous itself, you know, what we're reading today, I started in 2015, right after, right when Wilberforce was being published. And it was based on some, you know, events and parts of the story that I knew already. Like I knew what happened and the people and what the deal was. But the writing that I had about it, just I couldn't stand it. I didn't like the way it was written. I didn't like it. So I just tore it all up and started again with the same events and just told the story again in the way that it's now told. And so that took, what, from 2015 to 2018, really. I finished the draft of this last year.
Which, for a story of this depth, and it's a fairly hefty book, so that doesn't seem like all that long.
It was an intense, yeah, it was, I mean, it was a very intense period of writing, really intense period.
I bet.
Now, you talked about the style being somewhat experimental, and it seems like it was heavily influenced perhaps by Victorian era writing.
Well, I mean, in some ways, I'd say it's also influenced by playwriting. You know, there's a lot of dialogue in it, which I do with M dashes, kind of like Joyce does. And, So I don't really know what all the influences are. I mean, experimental, I probably shouldn't use that word. Nobody will buy it. It's not bizarre. But it has a lot of points of view, and the different points of view shape the way that the prose is, you know, because the mindset shapes what happens with it. So if it's experimental, it's like that.
A lot of points of view, a lot of depth in each point of view. You're really exploring from within each mm-hmm. perspective, and a lot of detail and a lot going on. And sometimes, you know, modern readers, sometimes it seems like may not have the patience for that level of detail. But it sounds, or it appears, that you have found readers who do.
Well, you know, I hope so. Mm-hmm. I think that it's for people who really love to get lost in a book. You know, it's not the kind of book that you're going to be able to plow through in your commute. And you know, if you're kind of trying to conquer books, it's going to take a while. It's a book that'll take you a few weeks to live with it. But there are readers who just want to go and become absorbed in another world. It's what reading was to me as a child and as a teenager, just being absorbed in these worlds. And I guess that might be one of the things you mean when you talk about Victorian writing.
Right.
And I guess those longer Victorian books too, there was the sense, or they give the sense that the change that the major characters undergo, it takes time. You got to live with them, and you got to live with the circumstances. It isn't just this kind of whip, television, action, done thing. So even though this is kind of a busy book, a lot of things happen. It's kind of quick in its way, but it does
exactly.
go on.
It's not really slow paced, which, you know, a lot of maybe books from, you know, Victorian time might have had a slower pace in most.
Yes.
So this isn't, I wouldn't say it's slow paced. It's just very full.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and that's a challenge for me because I'm writing about a palette. Like, I mean, I could tell you what happens the day after the book begins, or the day before it begins. So then you have this question of like, where do you raise the curtain and where do you lower the curtain and why? Like, where are you going to stop it? When do you turn the lights out on this version of the telling of the story? Because they live in my mind, so I could go on, but where do you start and stop it? You know, and that was a big challenge to me, of trying to find those points, or to justify why here and why there. And then if that's where you start and stop, then what is the story really about then? How are you shaping it with the beginning and ending?
And also,
those are tough questions.
The movement of the characters in the story, because they're all important in their own way. And
yes.
So they all need a voice, and so because it, the main characters, of course, but then these other ones, you know, they have to be heard too. So it would be difficult. I really admire that you were able to do this.
Well, I guess it, in some ways it was like, I suppose, what it must be like to write music, or, you know, with a bunch of musical parts, or conduct something. You know, you're trying to get the volume right on the different people, not let one person take over who doesn't deserve that much, but yet they need their motif to come to an end and just
uh-huh.
keep the focus and the volume on everyone, pardon me, titrated. And to the extent that succeeds, you know, I guess I'm lucky. It was kind of intuitive. I couldn't really explain how I made those choices.
Did you write the book in the order in which it's published, or did you, like, write one person's perspective and then another's and then fit them together like a puzzle?
This book was written from beginning to end as published.
Okay. When you say this book, does that mean others you might do differently?
Yeah, well, I'm working currently on a third book, which takes a couple of the characters from this book. It's set at Oxford in the 20s, and that one appears to be wildly non-chronological, and I don't quite know what I'm going to do with it. but this one, this and Wilberforce as well, really were written from just began at the beginning and wrote all the way through to the end. And, you know, of course you can go back and fill things in a little bit, but it was not puzzly. It was very much driven by time.
Now, are you, there's generally two types of writers that we've found. One who writes very quickly and then goes back and does a lot of editing, and the another that writes more precisely and doesn't like leave a chapter until they feel pretty, like that's pretty complete. Which one are you?
I'm more the first one. especially for something at this length, the only way I can really get it alive is to go fast. I'll leave a chapter, I'll go back to a chapter a couple of times until it seems like the drama is landing. Like if the dramatic moments aren't there, then you go forward based on nothing and then you get lost. So you kind of got to make the dramatic moments more or less hit. But as far as cleaning up stuff, I do that later. With this book, a lot of the editing was simply removing things. Just taking scaffolding away, whether that's chapters, sentences, words, just taking stuff away was the big editing task.
Well, Heather, before it gets too late, we need to hear from Grievous. Would you like to read some?
Sure. I'll just read from the beginning of the book. It's 1931. We're in Yorkshire at St. Stephen's Academy. There are little breaks in the book, like little, you know, the equivalent of the asterisks that indicate a point of view shift. So if I pause for a little longer, that's where we are. And there are also in this passage a few things that are in italics, and that indicates what a person is writing. So I don't know if I can convey that with my voice, but okay. if you hear a different tone, that's what's being conveyed that you would see on the page.
Great.
Okay. Ewes, lambs, pox lanes, ivy, rain, raining, rained upon. Third row of the removes history lesson, gray riding slouched as much as discipline would allow, pen, exercise book. Wednesday, half holiday, rain last five, rain today. Everything in sight had succumbed to the damp. Towels never dried, walls perspired. Games kit hung clammy in the changing room where mildew grew with abandon. 57th day, Lenten term, boredom chronic, boredom acute, the most dismal day in the year of our Lord, 1931. Then, in an instant, paper brightened, silence fell. Mr. Greaves left his lecture and drifted to the window. Gray lifted his pen. Could everyone feel it? Even the back of his throat had a taste, like what you smelled when spring came to wake up the ground and banish winter in a night. Gray wiped his spectacles. The rain had stopped, leaving only drips from the gutter. The remove saw it too, and when the bell rang, they cheered. Gray screwed the cap onto his pen, but the ink had run, pooling on the page and then smearing when he closed the book on the mess. After lunch, there was a wire. John took it from his matron and fumbled with the seal. Urgent notes never brought good news, but in this day and age, what hazard? He tore it in frustration. Mr. John Greaves, St. Stephen's Academy, near Fridaythorpe, Yorkshire. The tides at Lancaster came faster than a racing horse. If the drowning didn't get you, the quicksands would. He was a grown man and housemaster. He was 7 years old, and his mother was dead all over again. Where did it come from, all that water? Cordelia opened the window in the alcove off the ward, but when she stuck out her head, the rain was gone. Perhaps the Atlantic had dried up at last. Perhaps the spires of the lost city were poking through the seabed while England and the Emerald Isle drowned. When she was small, the rain had made her think of heaven. The angels are crying, Uncle John would tell her. Why? The sins of the world. What's that? Her godfather would open his mouth but say nothing. Where do angels come from? God made them. Where does God come from? They were one missed call over away from the cane. Gray hadn't been caned since the beginning of last term. a prank of Trevor's egg, saltpeter, chimney. But despite the recent rocky patch, he thought he could make it to Easter. He put only 35% on Trevor's avoiding the junior common room, but bets on Trevor, even with himself, were notoriously unpredictable. Gray wasn't a coward, he hoped. He'd survived as many as six from the JCR. But as a punishment, the cane contaminated days. You couldn't look the JCR prefects in the eye afterwards. The physical effects lingered. It was all unendurably personal. In Stalky, they didn't care. They took just punishment in their stride and exacted revenge for anything else. Valerius, likewise. Marks were a badge of honor to him, as they essentially were to Trevor. Trevor emerged from the washroom and led him through the post-luncheon throng. They might be on tight terms with the absence book, but they were, Trevor reminded him as they passed the school porter, no longer gated. Sun was breaking through the clouds, hours of half-holiday stretched before them, and there was no reason they oughtn't spend the afternoon at the keep and make it back well in time for callover. 98%, though you couldn't forget the standard deviation for Trevor himself. They strolled nonchalant past the juniors diving in the mud, past their compatriots in the remove, heading to the Fives court for battle, past upper schoolers choosing sides for ad hoc football. They walked without urgency, as if on routine ramble of their wide, wet bounds. Beyond the jousting fields of Castle Noir stands Grindelive Woods, alluring and entirely out of bounds. Their boots squelched as they circumnavigated the puddle cum lake that divided the upper and lower pitch. Beyond the woods, even more alluring and even farther out of bounds, stands Mackay's Bothy. They slid down the ditch that marked a boundary in cricket season. There is, in Bard's lore, a third route, through the woods, past the keeper, Grendle's Murder, the details of which have evaporated like mead at the bottom of a barrel. Slipping from sight, they dashed for the old lodge. For 3 years, it has been widely suspected that Valerius holds the keys to that byway. Did he not squire for the great Wilberforce, the great Wilberforce who, it is known, often took leave of Castle Noir to cavort with his men at the tavern in Fridaythorpe? Inside the ruined hut, they hauled up the stone. None of the men told how they were able to disappear from castle grounds, crawled down the chute, and then return, listing hours after the watch, wriggled through mildewed pitch black. If none of Wilberforce's men had told, who else could know but Valerius? Of course, the knights of Castle Noir find it difficult to imagine that young Valerius could hold the keys to such a fortress, but even as they resent the possibility, they hope for it. If secrets are not passed on, they pass away into dead knowledge. The ground sloped up, and they emerged into the woods, into air, light, and freedom. Their confinement at the academy, some from rain, some from gating, had lasted 3 weeks, and now as Trevor led them up the path, Gray saw that the streams had colonized the woods, presenting muddy ravines and newly fallen branches. He half expected to find the keep washed away, but as he and Trevor arrived at the wall above the barn, there it stood, stalwart and loyal. On the heels of his relief, fear flashed, like being told his name was on the notice board. What if the barn actually were to wash away or collapse? Inside the hollow wall, beyond the ledge that sheltered their books and cigarettes, beyond sight of anyone who looked without knowing what to look for, there in the heart of the barn, if such a place could have a pumping organ or seat of feeling, there, though he hadn't touched it or looked at it in years, though most of the time he let himself forget it was there, there, in the smoldering ashes or the rain-soaked splinters, however it happened, there, someone would find it. That's the end.
Thank you.
That's the beginning. Yes,
that's
yes.
The beginning.
Thank you for listening. Yeah, that's the end of the first chapter.
So gating is some sort of punishment, right?
It would be like being grounded, being confined to within the school gates.
Okay. And tell us a little bit more about Valerius.
Well, Valerius is a kind of knight-like character that Gray has invented that he writes about, who is the thinly veiled version of himself, except for that Valerius has all the courage that he doesn't have. So he's thinking, he's taking his regular life at the school and just masking it in this sort of medieval saga. It's sort of like Gawain and the Green Knight, or the kind of books that I read his age, the Lloyd Alexander Chronicles of Prydain or Lord of the Rings, like that kind of atmosphere. So he's imitating what he's read and, you know, making his life be like that, which is what one does at that age.
And it's kind of the play within the play.
Yeah, it's a story within a story. It's a story that he's writing the whole time. And at this point, the little snippets that we hear, they're very kind of funny. I mean, they're just sort of ridiculous, his writing. And later it gets a little better. And it does turn into a stage form later in the play, in the book as well.
And is there a connection between Wilberforce and Valerius?
Well, here in this part, because Gray himself was a fag for Wilberforce, so had that kind of mentor-mentee relationship with Wilberforce back in the day before when he was younger, he has created a kind of older knight character for Valerius and just kept the name. So he's written his own people into the book and just given that character the same name because he couldn't think of another one. So.
And one other thing that's a little confusing at first is the remove. Tell us what the remove is.
Well, so different schools call different grades different things. It would have been kind of a local tradition. But at St. Stephen's, the first year students, who would be kind of like eighth grade for us, like 13-year-olds, are the third form. And then the next year are the fourth form. Then the year after that, which would be like 10th grade, are the remove. And they're called the remove because they take an exam called the remove at the end of that year, which is will let them go forward into the upper school or not. Today in England, it would be around the same time that you would take your GCSE exams. Then there's the fifth form and then the lower and upper sixth. So those three grades are the, quote, upper school. And then the third and fourth forms are the lower school, and the remove is like the middle. And so that just happens to be the grade that Gray is in. I didn't make those terms up. Other schools had ones that were similar or in their own ones, and I just kind of picked ones from a variety of schools and assigned it to these kids.
Okay. Why have a lower sixth and upper sixth? Why not have sixth and seventh?
Well, that's just sort of historical tradition. The sixth form is the top form. But also today in England, the sixth form usually is 2 years, and it would be there are these public exams you take. The GCSEs are the kind of between the fifth form and then the sixth form. The last 2 years would be your A-level studies. And in England today, you're narrowing down and only focusing on three classes at that point. It's not really happening in the 30s, but to that extent, it does go on today. So it's just it's one of the irrational ways they name things over there, you know.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is H.S. Cross, author of Grievous.
Now, you have in the book in the very, very beginning, how do you pronounce this, Dramatis Personae?
Dramatis Personae, yeah, the character list.
Sorry, persona. Yeah, the character list, which is helpful. It's very
good.
Helpful.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah. Now, it would also be helpful to explain the grade things sometimes, just because they are often in the book, you know.
But, yeah, that would have been helpful.
So I have a question, Heather. How similar is St. Stephen's to Hogwarts?
Well, there's no magic. I mean, it has that. Kind of the romance and the mystery of it, and in its own way, I guess it has some of the danger. I mean, no one dies in this book. At Hogwarts, people are constantly dying.
That is true.
There's that. you know, they also have prefects at Hogwarts. I mean, Joanne Rowling took the English school story, and then she took the witch fantasy book, and she did a mashup, and that was what was so sort of surprising and exciting about the first of these books, which came out when I was teaching middle school. I read it, and I was like, oh, my gosh, she's mashed up the school story and the fantasy novel. No one's ever done that before, and it was really, or to this degree, so that was really fun. It certainly is, you know, nobody outside Hogwarts really understands what's going on there, and to an extent that's true of St. Stephen's or any school. They've got their own logic and their own culture and their own concerns, and it's very important to them and not really to anyone on the outside. I think that people who I do feel like Harry Potter, as different as it is from what I'm doing, at least has exposed a lot of people to the boarding school idea. you might know a little bit more where you stand than I did when I was 16 and I just had never even heard of a house. I didn't know what that meant, you know. So.
Uh-huh.
Absolutely.
Well, that's it, you know. I mean, just I had never read any of that, so this was a new experience for me.
Oh.
So, Heather, I understand that there's some musical connection with Grievous.
As you see in the, I mean, there's a choir at the school, so there's quite a bit of sacred choral music that's running through the novel that people are singing or listening to or whatever. And then it's the 20s and 30s, so there's especially when they go outside the school and through the young girl character Cordelia, are really into all of the popular music of the day. They're hearing it, and you know, you can't quote a lot in a novel if it's still in copyright. Some of the material was, so sometimes I couldn't put it all in. But I did make one of those Spotify playlists with the various songs that are referred to in the novel, and then this guy has a blog called Large Hearted Boy where he invites you to make little blurbs about all the music in your book, and so I've done it for this book as well. It's a fun little read-along if you want to read the book and then be able to listen to music that goes with various chapters. It's kind of fun if you're into that.
And is that all available on your website?
Yes. Yes, it is. There are links to that.
And
if you want, I can send them to you too.
And it's hscross.com.
That's right.
Yes.
Yes.
Why did you decide to publish as HS instead of Heather?
Well, and it's an interesting question. Part of it was it's such a masculine world, and I wanted kind of that neutrality of not instantly announcing a gender in the way that Heather does. Part of it is the tradition, you know, in England, even today, I mean, J.K. Rowling, speaking of Harry Potter, but certainly earlier in the 20th century and so on, a lot of female and male writers just went by their first two initials, you know, J.R. Tolkien, C.S. Lewis, right? Mm-hmm. And so I kind of wanted to stand in that tradition, and so I went with that. It seemed more native to the world that I was writing to do that. And then once I had decided to do it, I actually liked the slight distance from Heather, who everybody knows me as Heather and calls me Heather. It just, you know, being HS Cross, it created a little privacy for me in that way. To, you know, not have everyone that, you know,
yeah,
this, I don't know if this
understand.
Is related, but when I was a kid, I was on a television program in Michigan for 2.5 years in middle school. It was a weekly TV show called Kids World Magazine. It was like a children's news program in Detroit, and I was an anchor on it. And so locally, it was kind of like being a little famous. I mean, in the really rinky-dink way of Detroit in the 80s, right? And occasionally it would happen. And I mean, I was like a child actor, so I just, you know, who wouldn't want to be famous? And of course I did. But then occasionally, I remember one time I was buying shoes somewhere, and some girls came up and they were like, oh, Heather, you know, because they knew me from the show and I didn't know them. And I found it wildly alienating and not fun at all, actually. And so I don't know whether that's related at all to that desire to just have a slight distance there.
It makes sense. It makes sense. We only have a few minutes left. Tell us about your path to publication. So you sort of hit the, you got the golden ring, the major publishing house contract. How did that happen for you?
It was my third try trying to get an agent. You know, maybe 10 years before that, and this was with that book that I was describing that was set in Grosse Pointe, I had a young adult agent who tried to sell that book and it didn't work out. And then that just all died. And then I wrote something else and tried to get an agent for it and almost did and didn't quite. And then I went and wrote Wilberforce and was able to get an agent for that, and she sold it pretty quickly in about 6 weeks, and it was a two-book deal, and so these two books went with it. But, I mean, that was decades in the making.
So you were a long-term overnight success.
I guess, yeah. To the extent that everyone, you know, literary fiction, what's a success? But, you know, but it was absolutely my first choice publisher, and, you know, who I'd always, you know, wanted to be published with. So it was, to that extent, it was such a dream come true. And, you know, the editing that I received at FSG was two different editors, a different one for each book, was just such good editing. And I just will always be grateful for it, because it made both books so much better and made me a better writer in the process. And I'm not sure whether that kind of really great editing happens everywhere these days. I don't know.
Do you have any preliminary editing, like friends or writers group or people?
Yes.
That, yes.
Yeah, I have a writers group that, and we've been meeting now for, 18 years, really. And, you know, not always weekly, but there have been stretches where it is weekly. And, you know, we're meeting and we're reading our work aloud to each other, you know, regularly. And that sort of deadline of we're going to meet, I got to have some pages, really helps. I mean, we asked earlier what kept me going, and that was a big part of it, was having an audience to turn up for every week with something to read to, and who also may really believed in it, in the projects. You know, they were great and are great.
Good idea.
And are your other group members published authors as well?
A lot of them are actually writing for this are playwrights. So they were produced playwrights, and there some of them are writing for or trying to write for television now. One of them is doing memoir now. So none of the other ones were fiction writers, but we did share this theater background. And it was nice actually having different genres, because it wasn't so much a competitive feeling, and you could really cross-pollinate each other in a way, because I found the playwriting very stimulating to me.
Do you think you'll ever go
without being competitive?
Do you think you'll ever go back to playwriting?
I don't know.
Well,
probably not.
Okay. So we will end there because we're out of time, but thank you so much for being with us. And Mom,
thank you. Thank you so much for giving me the time. It's lovely to talk to you.
And Mom, do you have some closing words?
Well, this is kind of for the, I don't want to be a spoiler, but this is kind of for Greaves, the end of the book. But Will Rogers, who was, of course, a philosopher, said, "Don't let yesterday take up too much of today."
Ah, such a great quote.
Well, thank you, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Bye now.
Bye. Thank you so much.